Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Mean Old Lion Media presents Pregnancy Pearls. Meet Dr. Nicole Plenty, a double board certified OBGYN and high risk pregnancy expert. She's brilliant, well researched, and feisty. Growing tired of seeing complications of pregnancy that could have been prevented, she wanted a way to empower women through knowledge because, as she says, all doctors aren't created equal. This quest to educate women birthed this podcast, Pregnancy Pearls with Dr. Plenty.
Thanks for listening to Pregnancy Pearls Podcast with me, Dr. Nicole Plenty. Moms and dads, I won't lie, I am still very jet lagged from my trip to Japan. So if you ever fly halfway across the world, just plan for like 5 to 6 days to recuperate when you get back. Otherwise, you'll feel like you're running on fumes. But I can say that the podcast is always something I look forward to, so I always push through for you guys. Now, if you're listening on this day, which the day the show drops, happy May. We've made it to the month of Mother's Day. This is the month of lots of graduation ceremonies and summer planning and send-offs. And the weather, regardless of where you live, or at least almost where you live, the weather's pretty nice. So let's get out, get our sundresses on, and get out and about this month. Now, over the past few weeks, I've been asked a lot of questions from moms who are about to deliver, who are sort of nervous about what to do once they get home. Now, I realize a lot of us feel ill-prepared for life with a new little one once real life at home starts. And honestly, this is something that made me a little nervous as well. Like, what am I going to do with this new kid here, right? And so this is what I would do. And I felt like we should get into this topic. So let's get into the topic. So first of all, it's super exciting and nerve-wracking at the same time to imagine life with a new baby. It starts to sink in with most of us at about 34 weeks. That you won't be pregnant forever and that you actually have to have a baby at some point. And the how is this thing going to come out of me? Those thoughts start running through your head. And that's completely normal. You're like, okay, the baby's how big? How many pounds? Okay, my vagina is how big? Okay. But remember, your body, regardless of if you're having a C-section or a vaginal delivery, your body can do amazing things. And the vagina can do amazing things. And you can handle this. This is going to be a distant memory. You're going to look up and your kid is going to be like Harrison, 5 years old and running you. Now, my advice is to ask as many questions in the hospital as you possibly can and to try to sort of emulate what you did in the hospital at home. So the nurses usually wake you up every 3 hours in the beginning to breastfeed. It's annoying, but your support person, whether that be your husband, a parent, your best friend, or the choir member who plans to stay at your house for the next week now needs to become your nurse. So yes, you need someone else there in the beginning to make this scenario happen. Let people help you, Superwoman. It's okay. Your body is exhausted, and if given a minute to sleep, you will do it. Even your baby is exhausted. So in the beginning, your little one needs to be put on a feeding schedule as well. Once your baby starts crying in the first week, think of it as that they're starving, right? Now, they'll cry a little bit, remind you, but if you wake up to a screaming baby, they're starving. So you need to put your baby on schedule every 3 hours, even if your baby's not crying. Have your baby latch the breast, especially if you're breastfeeding, and go ahead and feed. The most important thing in the beginning is to keep yourself on a tight schedule. And the most important thing in that schedule is breastfeeding and the breastfeeding schedule so that you can get your milk production up. But you also need to take time for the following things. One, you need to bathe yourself. Yes, you do need to bathe yourself. You need to keep the vagina clean. I'm not talking about douching, but just making sure that that area is clean. And if you had a tear in the vagina, you need to make sure that that is clean, right? You need to make sure you're splashing, you know, clean water down there. If you had a C-section, you need to make sure you're wiping over that with soap and water and rinse that area. Yes, you can wash over your C-section scar. You're not going to scrub, okay? But you're going to gently wipe over with your sponge or your towel with soap and water, mild soap and water, and rinse over that incision. If you have a penis or a little bit of fupa, I call it, lift it up and make sure you're getting everything clean underneath it, okay? And rinse dry. And then when you get out of the tub or the shower, pat dry, okay? Again, you're not scrubbing anything. Just pat dry and make sure that it's clean and dry. For me, if you had a C-section, I also usually take like a little bit of like alcohol on a pad and I just wipe over that C-section scar. And that's like the first, you know, first week or so after you take a shower or a bath, just to make sure that it's going to be dry because alcohol dries things out. So just making sure that it's clean and dry to help reduce risk of infection. The second thing, you do need to check your C-section scar, like be intentional, even outside the shower, checking the scar, and meaning get a mirror, look at your incision, make sure that it doesn't have any redness around it. You will still have abdominal pain, meaning when you press, you'll have a little bit of tenderness around the incision. That's completely normal with wound healing, but you shouldn't have pain like at the top of your belly or over your uterus specifically. Mm-mm. Should be over the incision. You should have pain. You shouldn't have a lot of redness around there. And you might have a little bit of drainage that's like sort of blood tinge drainage. That's normal. But if you're like, every time I press in one area, I'm having like a gush of blood there. Or every time I press, I'm seeing pus. That's not normal. And that should prompt you to go back to the hospital because you may have an infection that's either starting to brew or one infection that's already set in if you have pus coming from it. And if that happens, we may need to open that area of the incision, irrigate that, clean it out, and put you on antibiotics. If you have a vaginal tear that you can feel, take a mirror, look down there. Again, make sure that it's not, you know, really swollen. Make sure it's not really red. Make sure you don't have any pus coming from that area too, because lacerations, although it's, you know, they don't commonly get infected like a C-section incision, they can. So you want to make sure you're keeping that clean and dry. Obviously, I don't want you to put alcohol over your laceration in the vagina. And I also don't want you trying to search up into the vagina. If it's like a tear that you can see from the outside, that's what you need to make sure you keep it clean and dry. Don't go searching inside of the vagina to see if you can feel stitches. Don't do that. Okay. Don't do that because you can mess something up that way. But if it's on the outside, an outside tear, just make sure you're keeping it clean and dry. And if you had a tear that goes into the rectum or close there, you know, stool comes from the rectum. So it's going to be pretty important that you shower daily and keep that area clean and dry. It's also going to be pretty important that you use stool softeners twice a day if you had a tear that's a third or a fourth degree laceration. Okay, that's one that either hits the sphincter of the anus or goes through into the rectum. If you had that, you want to make sure you're not straining. Okay, so you want to make sure you're drinking plenty of water and taking stool softeners twice a day to avoid any undue pressure on the laceration site. Next, you actually need to eat. You need to eat 3 meals and 3 snacks. You should have been eating that during the pregnancy. You need to keep this up, especially if you're breastfeeding. You should be eating more calories as a breastfeeding mom than you were during pregnancy. In pregnancy, you eat normally, and we ask you to increase your calories by about 300 calories a day. Once you deliver, we want you to increase your calories by about 500 calories a day. So you can see you should be eating more breastfeeding than you were during the whole pregnancy. Okay. So it's going to be really important that you're eating frequent meals and snacks throughout the day. And they need to be quick and easy because, again, you're going to be waking up every 3 hours to feed this baby. And that's not going to give you much downtime to do a lot of stuff. So you don't want to have to spend 2 hours in the kitchen cooking because then you're going to be really exhausted. So make them quick and easy. If you have a friend group who wants to help, people always say, how can I help? A meal train is a great way for them to do this. Have them say, hey, listen, you can sign up for this meal train. If you started or get a friend to start one so that for the first couple of weeks till you're on a schedule, you can have meals. Either people can do Uber Eats and have meals delivered to your home, or they can prepare a meal for you and drop it off. If you trust people, everybody's a little different about whose food they want to eat, but they can at least set up some meals from restaurants to be delivered. Because trust me, you will not want to cook. Now, if you have your support person that cooks, great, they can cook for you. If that person doesn't cook, again, go to the meal train, or they can also order takeout for the family. If you're somebody that's like, I have a support person, but it's a parent that's coming in the daytime and leave it at night, crockpot meals are great. Okay. Crockpot meals are your friend. You know, put your red beans and rice. You know, you can put your, you know, I love red beans and rice in a crockpot. I use a crockpot bag because I hate washing the crockpot, but a bag goes into the crockpot. And then if I cook red beans and rice, I'm putting my, you know, I'm a country girl. So I put a ham hock in there. I'm putting, you know, my 4 cups of water, 2 cups of rice. It's like 2-to-1 water, depending on how much you want to make. And then I'm chopping my sausage up and putting my sausage in there. And you just let it cook for 8 hours, literally. And it's the easiest thing. You obviously cut your onions and your bell peppers in there, put your seasoning in there, and just let it cook 8 hours. I set it before I go to bed. The next morning, the house smells amazing. Set the rice cooker and you have red beans and rice. And you can eat it for a couple of days. So that's just an example. I'm not telling y'all go make red beans and rice, although I will drop the recipe on my Facebook page. But crockpot meals are your friend when you just had a baby. Okay. Really, really important that you just make stuff quick and easy. Soup, red beans and rice, lasagna in the crock pot, like something that can be eaten over time, like throughout the day. You can also order takeout yourself if your coins are flowing like that. Okay. If you don't have friends that can do the meal train, you're like, you know what? I can just schedule Uber Eats myself. You can do that. If you have a lot of kids, not a lot, like even another kid, like I have Harrison, right? If I had another baby, you got to think about him too, right? So you got to make sure that you have snacks in the fridge. So your support person can be the person making groceries every week. They can also, you know, make a few like ready-go things like sandwiches, making bags that have like little snacks in it so that your kids will have stuff for lunch ready-made. They can make a peanut butter and jelly, ham and cheese. They can have their choice, but you're making a couple of them at a time to last about 2-3 days. So they have something to just grab and go so that you're not waking up and having to fix, you know, lunch for your kids, you know, every morning. Okay. So get in the habit of like pre-doing meals, having your support person do the meals. Friends that want to come over and help, that's something they can do. Hey, can you make meals for the kids for the next couple of days? Put in the refrigerator. Can you make lunch boxes for the next couple of days? Get people to help you. Anticipate what you'll need. And help doesn't always mean help with the baby, right? You got the baby. You're the milk supply. You have the baby, but helping you maintain the rest of the household is going to be what you need. Next bit of advice, drink a lot of water, okay? Breast milk is a lot of fat, but it's also a lot of water. So you got to drink a lot of water. So in pregnancy, we want you to drink 4 to 5 20-ounce bottles of water a day. That's 80 to 100 ounces of water. That same energy should be kept in the postpartum period, especially when you're breastfeeding. Okay, you got to have a lot of high fat content. You got to have the water. So make sure you remind yourself to drink a lot of water. Next, and I think this is tip number 5, monitor your swelling. So that first 2 weeks, you're going to swell up like a Michelin tire man. Okay, that's completely normal. But if you have a headache that doesn't go away with Tylenol, blurry vision or double vision or pain in the right side of your abdomen, which is like on the right side, right out of your rib cage, check your blood pressure. If it's high, meaning 140 on the top, that's your systolic blood pressure, or 90 on the bottom, that's your diastolic blood pressure. Or if you don't own a cuff and you have those symptoms, go straight to the hospital. These can be symptoms of preeclampsia, which is when you have high blood pressure and vascular damage, which we look for as protein in your urine. If you also have issues with shortness of breath or problems laying flat, this can be a symptom of fluid in your lungs or around your heart, because your heart isn't pumping effectively. That's called peripartum cardiomyopathy or heart disease because of pregnancy. Go to the hospital, okay, if you suspect that. It's better to be safe in the immediate postpartum period than to just assume everything's normal. So if you were able to lay flat during the pregnancy and the first couple of days afterwards and you get home a week later, you can't lay flat and you feel like you're sitting up and gasping for air, That's a problem. You need to get that checked out immediately. Things like preeclampsia and, you know, peripartum cardiomyopathy, we think, you know, these are pregnancy complications. But you got to think that there are things that happen after pregnancy. When we talk about severe maternal, you know, mortality, or people that pass away in pregnancy, or people that have complications, really hard complications in pregnancy, that it's not really in pregnancy. 85% of the time, it's after the baby comes. So it's really important. I'm not trying to scare you. This is not a scare tactic. But I have to give you the knowledge to know what to look for. So it's really important that you monitor these symptoms and reach out before anything troublesome happens. And if you're monitoring your symptoms and you go in and you're like, I had a headache that didn't go away, my blood pressure is 140 over 90, they'll admit you, monitor you, put you on blood pressure medicines, put you on magnesium, which helps prevent seizures in pregnancy, which is eclampsia. Okay, pre is before. Eclampsia is when you have a seizure because of hormones from the placenta. They'll put you on medicines to prevent those things. And then you'll go home a day or two later. Let's say you get there and your blood pressure is completely normal, your headache's going away. They'll check your labs to make sure your kidney functions normal, your liver functions normal, and then they'll send you home. You know, no, you know, nothing's lost there. But it's better to be safe and go in and nothing's happened. Okay, that's fine. Go home. Than for something to be going on and you don't, you know, you're chalking it up to this must be normal. Okay. Make sure it's normal. Okay. Go in. If you're at the point where like you're at the house by yourself with your baby and you don't have anybody else, you can always call the on-call doctor to talk to them to see if you need to come in. If you need to come in, then you would call 911 to get an ambulance to transport you and the baby back to the hospital. Okay. If you did not have transportation there. But it's very important not to ignore these type of symptoms. Okay. Very, very important. Next tip, monitor your bleeding. In the first few weeks, your bleeding is going to be similar to the heaviest day of your menstrual cycle. It'll eventually turn brownish and then yellowish and then white. But this could take 6 weeks. Okay. You can bleed for a whole 6 weeks and nothing's wrong. It could be completely normal. But as you go through the weeks, it should be lighter and lighter and lighter. And then it'll get brownish and then yellow and then white. Okay. This is lochia, and there's different lochia just means that lining shedding after the baby. And this is going to go through some transitions as that lochia, you know, changes, as that bleeding pattern changes. Tip 7, which is really not a tip, but it's just, you know, I got to say it. Get plenty of sleep. Okay. Plenty of sleep. In the beginning, it'll take your body a few weeks to get adjusted. Why? Because you got a new baby and you're waking up all the time. You'll need to sleep when the baby is sleeping in the beginning, because you'll wake up every few hours to feed. Babies feed about every 3 hours in the beginning. So you and your support person will have to act as a team. Okay. Taking turns to keep the bottles and supplies clean. Now, what I did was watch items immediately after I used them in the beginning. Because I had issues with Harrison latching because he had, a tongue tie and he had to get a tongue clipping. And even after that, he didn't latch as well. So I pumped. And so after I pumped and, you know, if it was time for him to feed, I'd feed him right after I pumped. If it wasn't time for him to feed, then I would go downstairs, put the milk in the storage little baggie, put the bag in the refrigerator, and then I would wash my pump supplies immediately and put them to dry. That way I'm not waking up to a sink full of dishes. Trust me, you do not want to wake up to a sink full of dishes. If it's your husband that's going to put the breast milk up while you have the baby latch, maybe get him in the routine of also putting the milk in the storage container or storage bag, putting the bag in the refrigerator and washing your supplies while you're feeding the baby. It's important that whoever's helping you is washing the supplies. Okay. You do not want to wake up to a sink full of dirty dishes. Okay. Or having to stay up for an hour because now you got all these little pump pieces to wash. And y'all, those pump pieces are annoying. It's like all these little pieces have to be taken apart. They had to be cleaned with the little, you know, sponge. They got the little bitty skinny thing that you have to get into the little tubing. Like all that stuff is really annoying. And if you can keep your seal sealed, like that little tubing, you shouldn't have to wash that. But if you accidentally get milk in it, then obviously you have to wash it and let it dry. or get a new tubing. That was my favorite. Just get a new tubing. Because sometimes it's very annoying to wash it and takes forever to dry. The other piece is some of those things, if you don't wash them, you know, that they can get mildew in them, y'all. It can be, you know, bad for the baby to take in milk from dirty milk, you know, dirty breast pump supplies. Okay. So you want to make sure that you're actually washing your pump supplies. Okay. So I say wash it immediately before anything gets dry or gunky on there. Wash it. And it is hard to wash. You do need specific, you know, detergent, dishwashing liquid to wash it, because like I say, breast milk is high fat. So everything's going to feel like a little bit filmy, greasy, like that's normal. And if you let your bottle sit, you'll see the separation of like fat from the rest of it. And you'll have like a film of fat in the bottle. That's normal because breast milk is really high fat. But think about it. It's like letting, you know, chicken fat dry and like chicken grease dry. It's going to be hard to get that greasy filmy off of it. So you want to go ahead and wash that hot soap and water and do it immediately, or let your support person do it immediately. Because again, you don't want to wake up to a sink full of dirty dishes. Next tip, and probably my last, is wash your clothes every day. Not your clothes, but the baby stuff every day. Why do you think you need to wash every day? Because let me tell you, you're going to go through a load every day. Between the swaddles that get spit up on, the burp cloth that you're going to use, you know, you're going to use a few of those, the onesies you're going to have to change, the little socks, the little hats, like all that stuff adds up. And I used to keep a pile of baby stuff that I would go through at the door. And every night I would wake up from my 3 a.m. feeding and I would go ahead and start a load. And then at 6 a.m. for the next feed, I put that load in the dryer. Now, my ex-husband, who was obviously my husband at the time, made it his responsibility to wash the other clothes one or two times a week. And then we would fold them together watching TV, you know, during the day. So everyone's a bit different, but you have to get on schedule. And if you're not somebody, because eventually you won't use as many burp cloths. Like once your kid gets on a regimen, they may not spit up as much. Maybe even wash baby's clothes every other day, right? And maybe you wash, you know, the adult towels and clothes every other day. But either way, get into a routine and don't do it all by yourself. Okay. It takes a village. And so whoever is going to be there helping should be there doing something to help. And like, I hate when people come over like, oh, can I come over and see the baby? I can come help with the baby. No, you don't need help with the baby. You need help with the other children. You need help with the meal prepping. You need help with the cleaning. You need help with washing clothes. So I tell people, if you're going to have people over that you have to entertain, they should not come over the first 8 weeks. They're not allowed over. Okay. Those in-laws that want to sit and just hold the baby all day. No, we don't need those in-laws. We need the in-laws that's going to understand that you're going to have the baby latched to your hip and you need to get some rest and the baby needs to get some rest. And they're going to be in there frying fish and they're going to be cleaning the oven and wiping the counter down and sweeping. And you're going to wake up and be like, oh my God, this is amazing. Can you move in forever? Not the people that you have to figure out, like, what are we going to feed them? Like, what are they going to eat? No. We need self-sufficient friends and in-laws. And if you thought you were my friend and I had to fix you a plate, you're not my real friend. You don't do that to somebody with a newborn. You come over. Don't come up with your cute clothes on. Don't come up. Don't do that. Come up with your sweatpants on, a t-shirt. You come by to drop the baby a gift off. Wash the dish real quick. Wash the dish real quick. Look in the refrigerator. Clean the refrigerator out. Bring groceries with you to the house. Here's fruits. Hey, I know you got another 2-year-old and a 5-year-old. Here's some diapers for the 2-year-old. Here's some fruit snacks. Hey, I prepackaged chips for you. Be helpful. Hey, I saw the clothes in the dryer. Let me take the clothes out of the dryer. Let me fold them up for you. Do not visit your friends that just had babies without being helpful. Don't leave there without doing something. And I'm not talking about holding that baby. Don't hold that person's baby. That is my pet peeve. You coming over to see the baby. I'm exhausted. I feel like I have to get up and get dressed for you because I got real company. Just don't come over. Just don't come over. That's why I don't visit people in the first couple months. Unless I'm comfortable enough around your house, in your sink and clean your toilet, I'm not coming over the first 2 months. If I'm comfortable enough to get the Swiffer and clean your house, I'm gonna come over because I can be helpful. But otherwise, I'm not helpful. I'm a burden. I'm somebody you have to entertain. And if you're listening to this and you don't have a baby, you just listen for knowledge, let this be your aha moment. Okay. And when you go visit your friends that just had babies, grab a mop, grab a broom. Even at, oh no, you don't have to do anything. Mm-mm. You go pee, clean the toilet after you leave, clean the floors, grab, see if they have cleaning supplies under there, wipe the mirrors down. Okay. Be helpful. Be helpful. Okay. So now that we've talked a little bit more about what you can expect after discharge and about how you need to get on schedule, let's go to some cases and questions.
Our first case is a 34-year-old who is 3 days postpartum. She delivered via C-section at 39 weeks and had chronic hypertension that was well controlled. Her postpartum course was uncomplicated. She had vaginal bleeding lighter than her typical menstrual cycle and breastfed without issue. She was discharged this morning. Now, 7 hours later, she woke up at home with a fever of 102. So she came back to the hospital complaining of a fever and generalized pain. Her physical exam is unremarkable except for breast engorgement. However, her husband is a physician and thinks that she has an infection in her uterus and desires that to be treated. You were consulted for evaluation and management.
It sounds like the issue here is the fever. And she got the fever because she went home and slept. Remember when I said earlier, hey, if you get a second, your body will just go to sleep? Because having a surgery, even if it's not a C-section, even if you didn't have a baby, let's just talk about surgery and wound healing. Let's say you broke your arm and you had an arm surgery. You had anesthesia. Your body is exhausted just from the anesthesia, okay? And then you talk about the energy that takes for wound healing. It's a lot. The blood loss, and now your body is revving up energy to produce more red blood cells. It's a lot, okay? It's a lot. And so you naturally are going to try to recuperate, right? When people have to recuperate from a surgery, what do we tell you to do? Go home, get some rest, hydrate. This is the only major surgery we tell you. Don't do that. Don't you go home and sleep for 8 hours. Don't get a good night's sleep. Don't get a good night's sleep. Think about it. Any other surgery, we'll be telling you, go home, get rest, hydrate, stay in the bed, have somebody take care of you, right? Except for a C-section. We tell you, do not go home and get 8 hours of sleep. Let that sink in. You can't go to sleep. Why? Because something like this will happen. So what happened is her husband probably said, oh, she's exhausted. I'm going to take care of everything by myself. I'm going to look at this baby. I'm going to take care of this baby. And I'm going to let her get some sleep, right? He thought he was doing her a favor. I'm going to let her get some sleep. Now she has a physical exam. She has big old breast engorgement. And you know what happens when your breasts get engorged? They get inflamed. They get angry. And you get a fever. And yes, you can have a fever and it not be mastitis. It's just because of breast engorgement. And the difference between breast engorgement causing a fever and mastitis is really timing, right? If we've been breastfeeding for a couple of weeks and we have engorgement and pain and a cyst or something red, like a mass, that's usually mastitis. We can see the red streaks up. That's mastitis. If you just have swollen breasts, it's only been a couple hours, you know, a couple hours since you last breastfed, that's engorgement. All right. And usually with mastitis, we relieve that fever by doing what? Expressing, pumping, getting rid of the engorgement. Now, do you want to breastfeed when you're engorged? Yes, we want you to breastfeed. Do you breastfeed when you have an infection or mastitis? Mastitis is caused by actual bacterial infection in the breast. Yes, we do. We want to breastfeed both times. Is it pleasant? No, it hurts like hell. It's awful, right? You feel like your breasts have been beat by somebody with a bag of Crown Royal nickels. You really are in pain. Your breasts feel like they're about to blow up. And your breasts also feel like a sack of nickels. They're hard. They're lumpy. And the last thing you want to do is go and press and express or have some kid sucking to get rid of the milk inside, right? But you gotta do it. You gotta relieve the engorgement. So what I usually tell people to do is get yourself, and we don't want you to do any warmth, right? People, I want to get my milk production to come in. I want my warmth over my breast. Well, that's going to cause milk production to really come in, right? But when you're engorged, you do need the pores or the glands to open up. So we tell you to take a warm shower. While you're in the shower, you want to hand express. You want to push the milk toward the nipple. Squeeze, push the milk toward the nipple, and you will get some milk to come out. Yes, it is like wasting liquid gold, but that's the easiest way to express is in the shower. Because if you just pump without that soothing of in the shower, it's going to really hurt. So you want to express. Then what I tell people to do is let the baby latch. Okay. Let the baby latch. That's going to be less traumatic and less of a pull than an actual pump. Because the pump is just going to cause you to produce more milk faster, right? But if your baby's not latching like my baby wasn't, of course, you're going to have to pump. And then right after you pump, ice packs, right? Because you want to slow the production down. Express, okay, whether that's in the shower or whether that's letting the baby latch. You express in the shower, you want the baby to latch right after that. Then after you have emptied the breast, put ice packs down to slow that engorgement back down, okay? That will be helpful. Now, some people preemptively put people on antibiotics for mastitis while we're figuring out whether that's mastitis or not. That's not wrong. But you don't have to have antibiotics for just engorgement. The goal of engorgement is get rid of the engorgement. Pump, latch, express, ice packs. Very important. Okay. And it may take you pumping and allowing the baby to latch, or it may take you expressing and latching a couple of times for you to feel like really relief from the engorgement. Most people, after they have pumped, they feel some relief, right? They feel some relief. But 3 days, you know, breast milk is just coming in day three. Before you have like that clear colostrum, you know, you might have a little bit of milk, but not much. And then your breast milk starts to rev up at day three. And so she went to sleep at a time where her breast milk production was really revving, right? And so she became really engorged. So expressing in the shower, latch, then ice packs are going to be what's needed. Now, mind you, we do want to do a physical exam to make sure we don't see anything that like red streaks or a mass or abscess that may make us think it's mastitis, which needs to be treated with antibiotics. If there's an abscess, obviously that abscess needs to be drained. We also want to check. She had a C-section incision to make sure we don't see any evidence of like pus coming from the incision, redness around the incision, or something that could also present with a high fever. We want to make sure that the uterus is not tender itself, not the incision, but the uterus. And that's if we press at about the belly button, which is usually where your uterus is around day three. If you're jumping off the bed, that could be that you have an infection in your uterus and you may need broad spectrum antibiotics for treatment of what's called endometritis or an infection of the lining of the uterus. We also want to make sure that you don't have any blood clots in your legs. You've been laying around a lot. So if you have swelling, calf tenderness, you know, or redness in your calf muscle, especially if it's on one side, not the other, that can mean you have a DVT. You want to make sure we are doing ultrasound of your legs to make sure that you don't have that. Or you could have a pulmonary embolus that presents with a fever as well, high fever. So we want to make sure we're checking those areas of the body to make sure you don't have that. We want to check your lungs to make sure you don't have pneumonia. Okay. And you may, if you hear crackles, you may need to do an X-ray or a CT scan to make sure we don't have anything in your lungs like a pneumonia or, like I said, a PE or pulmonary embolus, which is the blood clot that broke off from your leg and went to your lung. All these things can cause you have a fever. Okay. Also, you know, you got stuff going on around the vagina and the ureter. The urethra, got to make sure you don't have a UTI, a urinary tract infection. So we're going to check your urine, make sure nothing's going on there. So we're going to check all of these organ systems to make sure we don't have these things going on. But the most glaring thing is that everything was unremarkable except for the breast engorgement. So I'm going to go with the breast engorgement because that's the most common reason that people could get a fever this quick, especially if it's 7 hours later and you woke up, which meant that you didn't pump between now and then with a fever. The case pearl for this case is breast engorgement is common and can present with a really high fever. All right, medical intern, what's our next case?
Our second case is a 25-year-old who is 5 days postpartum from a vaginal delivery that she had at 38 weeks. She has no medical problems. She had a water birth for delivery without complications. However, she noticed heavier vaginal bleeding over the last day or so and had a passage of large clots in the toilet a few hours ago, which prompted her to come back to the hospital. You were consulted for evaluation.
Okay, so she had a water birth, which meant that she either had a water birth in the hospital or she had one at home. I don't know which one, but the thing that makes me a little concerned here, because you can pass clots here and there, that's not a big deal. But if you went from having vaginal bleeding lighter than a cycle to all of a sudden you have heavy bleeding and large clots, to me, this constitutes a postpartum hemorrhage or heavy bleeding after delivery. And that should prompt you to go back to the hospital like she did. Now, usually a postpartum hemorrhage, or if you have a heavier bleeding, we're going to check your blood count or a complete blood count or CBC to see if your blood count significantly dropped from what it was at the time of delivery. Now, if she had a home birth, then we don't know what it was at the time of delivery. So if she's anemic, that's going to prompt us to say, okay, let's continue to monitor this to see if it continues to go down if she's still bleeding. Now, if she's bleeding super heavily, then in addition to an ultrasound that we would do to look at the inside of her uterus to make sure there's not anything retained, like little membranes that can be retained from the placenta, then we would do a DNC or a dilation and curettage, which is a surgery where we scrape the inside lining of the uterus to make sure that we don't have anything that can continue to shed. So we're going to do a DNC to treat that heavy bleeding. And if she's still bleeding after the DNC portion, then your OBGYN will place a tamponade balloon, which, you know, old school be a Bakri balloon inside of the vagina or through the vagina inside of the uterus to sort of exert pressure on the wall of the uterus to cause like a tamponade. Some people also pack the uterus with like moistened laparotomy sponges or these laps to also cause a tamponade, okay, of the uterus. Really important that you tamponade the uterus or those vessels so they won't continue to bleed. So if you have a balloon placed, then that would mean that that balloon stays in place usually for 24 hours and we slowly let the liquid out. But usually saline that we put in the balloon to cause it to expand and tamponade the inside of the uterus. We're going to, you know, take out some of that fluid little at a time over a couple hours after it's been in for about 24 hours. And then basically as that balloon decompresses, if you're not bleeding, then eventually we take the whole balloon out, monitor you, make sure you're not bleeding anymore. It's very common for people to have like little filmy membranes. It's hard to get everything sometimes, especially if the placenta did not come out in one piece. So that could be the reason that you're bleeding because your body is going to try to get rid of all the membranes that are there. So if there's any little piece of membrane, you're going to bleed to try to shed that lining of the uterus, even if it's a little bitty piece. Okay. So a little bitty piece can cause you to have heavy bleeding until we've gotten rid of it. Sometimes, most of the times, a DNC or just scraping the inside will get any extra little filmy membranes that may have been left, and that's enough. But sometimes some people bleed more, and that's when we have to have like that tamponade balloon in there to make sure that you're not bleeding heavily. Also, we give you medicines to cause your uterus to sort of firm up. Okay. Sometimes we give you Cytotec. Sometimes it's Pitocin that we give you to help the uterus stay firm. Sometimes it's Hemabate or Methogen. So you'll hear about these different agents and different medicines. These are just medicines that cause the uterus to firm. We give you those agents. If that doesn't work and, you know, the DNC doesn't work and the tamponade doesn't work, then sometimes we have to get our interventional radiologists involved who do, basically uterine artery embolization to sort of, you know, cut off blood supply to feeding vessels of the uterus. Okay, so you slow down blood supply to the uterus, then obviously you can slow down the uterus bleeding. And so there are different things we do depending on how heavy you're bleeding. But the most important thing is to recognize when your bleeding is a problem. So if your bleeding went from, hey, this is a little bit heavier than my cycle, to this is heavy like a cycle, you got discharged home, it was, you know, sort of like your heavy cycle days, and then it's getting less and less like your cycles would get, okay? Then all of a sudden you're starting to bleed heavily, go back to the hospital. That is considered a hemorrhage, okay? That's a new hemorrhage. That should not happen. Well, some people, they get concerned because they're like, I've been bleeding for 2 whole weeks. That's normal, y'all. You can bleed for up to 6 weeks. Okay. That is completely normal. So it's not the length of the bleeding that concerns us. It is the amount of blood loss all of a sudden. Okay. You go from, you know, steady bleeding for a week. That's heavy, like your cycle, your heavy day, your cycles. Now you're bleeding another week, like your, you know, normal cycle day, like a medium flow day of your cycle. And then you're bleeding like a light cycle day the next week after that. And then all of a sudden you're heavier than your cycle. Okay. That's a problem. Okay. We need to make sure we're evaluating you and that you're not going to just all of a sudden start to bleed and bleed and bleed. And then you're super anemic and dizzy. So just always get yourself evaluated if your blood, your bleeding pattern suddenly increases when it was previously decreasing in quantity. So the case pearl for this case is a sudden increase in vaginal bleeding should always prompt you to go to the hospital, even if you had a home delivery. Even if you don't have a doctor at that hospital, go to the hospital, right? Because you need an ultrasound. You may need a surgery. You may need blood. And you can't do that at home. All right, medical intern, do we have, what's our next case or question?
This is a question and it says, Dr. Plenty, I had issues breastfeeding with my first baby. Now I'm 38 weeks pregnant with my second child. Is there anything I can do to help me successfully breastfeed after this pregnancy?
So I struggled with breastfeeding as well, and I breastfed and supplemented for 6 months and then stopped. And, you know, to this day, I wish I had breastfed longer, but you can only do what your body will allow you to do and what your mind will allow you to do. So the first thing I would tell you is that this is a different pregnancy. Okay. Just because you had issues with your first does not mean you're going to have issues with the second. Your body sort of knows what to do now. Second, the first baby is always the hardest because your body doesn't know what to do and you don't know what to do. And now your body knows what to do and you know what to do. I also don't know what happened with your first baby. I don't know if you went full term and you had the baby vaginally or if that baby was a preemie. Preemie babies, your body is also preemie. Your breast milk isn't ready to come in and you're sort of forcing it to come in. So it's harder to breastfeed with a premature baby than it is with a term baby. So I don't know. And not saying you can't, a lot of people with premature babies breastfeed, but it is harder to get that milk production to come in. So I don't know what happened, but I want you to first get in the mindset that you are going to breastfeed. Second, you need to go balls to the wall with eating and water. Okay. That's the thing I really made a mistake about. I did not have much of an appetite after I delivered and I lost a lot of blood. And so my volume was already down, meaning my blood volume was already down and I did not replete myself. So you really need to drink a lot of water. You can add Dasani drops, Crystal Light to the water. You need to drink a lot of water and you need to increase your fat content. Okay. Remember, I said breast milk is a lot of fat. So you do need to increase your fat content. This is the time that you need to increase your calories and be intentional about eating. I remember being paranoid and wanted to like move around, lose weight. I was really paranoid about how much weight I gained, even though I didn't gain a lot of weight with Harrison. This is not the time. Like the first month is not the time for that. You do not need to cut back. People that are good producers are good eaters. So you need to increase the amount of food that you're eating. And if you can, have your baby latch as soon as possible. Lactation consultation can help tremendously with latching and positioning of the baby, but you have to have that baby latch as soon as possible. And in the beginning, you want to have the baby latch as much as possible. Even though moms are paranoid, like, how do I know my baby's getting enough food? If your baby's not crying, your baby's getting enough food, right? If your baby's still hungry, your baby will start to cry. Okay. That may mean that you may need to pump to see if you're producing yet. But once you know you're producing and you know you get an adequate amount, have your baby latch. Okay. The latching, the suckling effect helps with milk letdown and it helps with milk production. The more you allow your baby to latch, the more your body will produce. It's supply and demand. Okay. In the beginning, your baby's not demanding much. So your supply is going to be lacking. As your baby grows, your baby will demand more. And so your body will demand, will produce more. So the more your baby latches, the better. So that first month, have your baby latch every 3 hours. Make sure you're drinking a lot of water. And also make sure you're getting a lot of fat and protein into your diet. Very important. three meals, three snacks. And I would say Greg's like a cow, snack throughout the day. Now, if you're somebody that's still like doing that and you're like, you know, did that for a week and your milk hasn't come in yet or is still lacking, then there are supplements, but you know, your lactation specialist is going to tell you, try not to do it with a supplement because you don't want to get super engorged. But mother's milk tea is like, everybody talks about mother's milk tea. It is very good with helping milk production. There's also breast lactation cookies that are like a oatmeal cookies that have fenugreek in them and milk thistle that help with increased breast production. You can also get, you can get supplements of fenugreek and milk thistle if you want to do that. There's also liquid gold. Those are drops that you can add to your water or to your food that have these, you know, fenugreek in them that can help with breast milk production. So very important not to supplement unless you actually have to, because we don't want you to get too engorged. But if you are 100 under producer, you might want to consider those. My OBGYN recommended liquid gold, which is why I got liquid gold. I also have mother's milk tea. I like teas. So you can doctor it up. You can make it taste really good. And if you drink a tea a day until your breast milk production comes in, that would be very, very helpful. But again, if you're already producing, don't push it because you will get engorged using these, you know, milk production supplements. All right, medical intern, do we have any more email questions or cases? And she's shaking her head no. So thanks you guys so much for listening to Pregnancy Pearls Podcast. I hope that you've learned more about preparing for your postpartum journey and what to expect. If you enjoyed the show, make sure to share me with your friends, rate and comment. If you or someone you know has had a pregnancy complication or unique pregnancy situation, let me know about it. Email me at pregnancypros@gmail.com to hear your topic or case discussed on one of our podcast episodes. Also, remember to follow me on Instagram at pregnancy_pearls and Facebook at pregnancypearls. You can also feel free to check out the website, which is www.drnicoleplenty.com for free pregnancy downloadables. And for goodness sakes, catch up on all four seasons of the podcast. In closing, remember to advocate for yourself. You are your biggest advocate, and no one knows what's going on with your body except for you. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Pregnancy Pearls is hosted by Dr. Nicole Lee Plenty. Produced by Nicole Plenty and Janine Brunson Johnson. Executive producer Ken Johnson. Find Pregnancy Pearls on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Please subscribe and rate. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice for diagnosis or treatment of individual medical conditions. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with specific questions regarding a medical condition. Pregnancy Pearls is a Mean Old Lion Media production.